This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we tell stories about everything here on this show, including your stories. Send them to ouramericanstories.com. They're some of our favorites. And now we have a story from one of our listeners, Paul Kotz, who's from the Twin Cities, where we broadcast on WCCO AM 830. Paul is a professor at St. Mary's University of Minnesota. Here he is to share this story.
Yesterday, I went to fill up my tank at Speedway, went inside to purchase some food items, and the friendly clerk said, "Do you have your card?" I flashed my barcode on my keychain, exchanged an excited comment about getting a free donut, collected my bag of items, and exited. Back at the car, I discovered that I could not find my keys. Funny, I don't remember being absent-minded. I checked my front pockets frantically. Maybe I left them in the car. No luck. Life is now officially unfair, I'm thinking to myself. I went back in to check with the clerk, and people were waiting in line. "Did anyone see some keys on the counter?" Someone remarked, "He lost his keys." No luck again. I just had them, but I felt a heightened sense of panic. And I'm thinking, if all is not lost, where are my keys? I went back outside, and as I checked my front pockets one more time, I tried my back pocket, and they magically appeared. What? I never put my keys there. Relief settled in. Soon, I will be able to hide my own Easter eggs. You know, but life has so many twists and turns. In the morning, I've been trying to work out at a fitness center in our area. As I'm exiting with my mask on, a woman was headed inside and proceeded to tell me that they need to stock the women's restroom with more toilet paper. Miss, I'm sure they can help you at the desk. I was not able to finish my sentence, and the reprimand continued. And the floors in there could use some cleaning, too. She seemed to be on a mission and breezed by me. Later, I told my wife Jan what happened, and she laughed. "You look like a person in charge. That's what happened." You know, I like people, and whether I make eye contact or not, they seem to find me. I was within a hotel with historic charm in the heart of the old main district of Dubuque, Iowa. I enter an elevator from the basement level, and in this case, there's nowhere to go but up. A man is occupied in some texting, and I press the button for my stop on the 8th floor. He states, "I guess I never pushed which floor I need to go to." "Well, you want to go to the main level?" I suggested. He acknowledged, "Yeah, that works. Got my head stuck in this phone just like the kids." It's easy to do," I said, and I pressed the button. Later that day, I spent some time at an indoor pool on a Monday and made my way to the nearby whirlpool that was right next to it. I met a little guy who emerged from the hot tub after being submerged underwater. I realized he should not be doing this, and after a brief introduction, said to the young man that he could get hurt, but that I was impressed with his ability to stay under hot water for such a period of time. He told me his name was Takien. His brother Prince soon joined us, and the other older sister spent her own quiet time in the pool. The young men told me they were from Chicago, and they were moving to Houston in August. "Do you know where I'm from?" "Texas? New York? Chicago?" "No, further north," I said. Takien asked, "Do you live in an ice state?" And then he ran back to the pool to cool off. I smiled yes for part of the year. "Heaven?" asked Prince. I said to him, "You know, we're all under heaven, you, me, and the people outside." "I live in Minnesota," I continued. "You live in an igloo?" I explained that this does happen, but not in our state very often. Alaska and the North Pole have some igloo living, as far as I know. Prince said, "I'm going to heaven. So is my sister." I said, "Well, what about your brother?" "No." Pensively expressed, "He's going to hell." I said, "How do you know?" Before any answer was given, Takien joined us again. He proceeded to tell me that he and his brother were now working on tablets in school and hadn't been back for days. "What is your name?" inquiring minds wanted to know. "My name is Paul. Some of my friends and family call me Polly." Prince processed this and said, "You should change your name to Landon." That was a first. I've been called many things, but I told Prince that I would consider this, but to legally change it would take some work. "How about Camden?" Takien suggested. Man, these kids, the possibilities are endless. The older sister emerged from the pool, was now checking on the two boys, and gave them some direction to not make too much commotion in the hot tub. They gave her a splash. "Don't mess with the older sister," I'm thinking to myself. Her look of admonishment worked. They quieted down. She said, "I ain't playing." "So you are headed to Houston?" I inquired. "Yeah, with my little brothers." "Hey, you're a very good sister. You can tell they look up to you." Takesha rolled her eyes. "Thank you." The three delightful young people sat and we continued to talk about stuff and things. "Well, it's time for me to go. It's been a pleasure, gentlemen and miss." As I was drying off, the kid who purportedly was going to hell came up and offered his hand to me and said, "I wanted to shake your hand so I won't forget you." Wherever I'm headed, heaven or hell, I won't forget this young man and his family. I hope they make it to Houston in one piece.
And a little slice of Paul Kotz's life from the Twin Cities, WCCO AM 830. Paul's stories of camaraderie and fellowship with fellow citizens in this country here on Our American Stories. Folks, if you love the great American stories we tell and love America like we do, we're asking you to become a part of the Our American Stories family. If you agree that America is a good and great country, please make a donation. A monthly gift of $17.76 is fast becoming a favorite option for supporters. Go to OurAmericanStories.com now and go to the donate button and help us keep the great American stories coming. That's OurAmericanStories.com. This is Our American Stories, and we tell all kinds of stories here on this show, as you know. Jerry Bergman has taught science for 45 years at university in subjects like biology, genetics, chemistry, biochemistry, anthropology, geology, and microbiology. He has 9 degrees in the field of science, including 7 graduate and postgraduate degrees. Dr. Bergman's here to tell us the story of a teenage boy who became interested in snow. On January 15, 1885, at 20 years of age, he became the first person in the world to photograph a snowflake. Here's Dr. Bergman with the story.
Well, his background is he's from Vermont and a lot of snow there, and he became interested in science. And his parents were very supportive. Even though they really couldn't afford it, they bought him things like a microscope and a camera so he could take pictures. And among his many interests was the weather. He actually charted the weather and tried to correlate the weather with other events. But he became especially interested in snowflakes. And he could, with a small magnifying glass, he could see they looked different. And so he tried to figure out why are they different? What's going on here? And of course, the problem is a microscope requires light, and light produces heat. And the heat melted the snowflakes. So he had to come up with a way of getting it cold enough to get the snowflakes and examine them, work quickly so he could get pictures without the snowflakes melting. And he was finally able to do that. In fact, he was the first person ever to get a photograph of a snowflake. And so that was quite an invention for a young boy. He was homeschooled, by the way. He didn't go to public schools. And his mother was a teacher, so she was very supportive of his work. So he was somewhat independent, I guess, his whole life. His full name was Wilson, or Willie, they called him, his childhood name, Bentley. And his name often is called Snowflake Bentley because he did so much work in this area. And he wanted to explore the world of science firsthand. And he saw God not only in the scriptures, but he saw God in the natural world. And as a result of his studying the natural world, he just realized he could learn a great deal about God through studying God's creation. And once he noticed they were different, he wanted to photograph them because he felt that the glory of God can be revealed through snowflakes. And of course, people thought that was silly because, come on, the glory of God can be revealed through snowflakes? This is silly. But he saw snowflakes as miracles of beauty. And it seemed to him the beauty of this should not be hidden. It should be seen and appreciated by others. So how can you do that? You can do that basically by getting pictures. And he, when he photographed them, he realized that the key is the conditions can't be too cold because then the snowflakes are brittle. It can't be too warm because then the snowflakes melt. And so therefore, he really was a good experimentalist. I mean, he must have spent hours and hours and hours of failures. And he realized that, well, this has to be done. And he had things all set up to get pictures and something would happen. He didn't get a picture. He wasn't fast enough. And so he had to work out his system so that he was able to accurately get snowflakes. And once he did so, he was able to photograph a few, 10, 15, 20. And then after a while, he ended up with about 5,000 snowflake images for the 46 years that he worked on this. And so he had a lot of pictures. One interesting thing is that even though he wasn't a scientist, never went to school, he was home educated, he ended up publishing in some of the leading science magazines in the world. He wrote the article on snow for the Encyclopedia Britannica, and that was quite a privilege in his day, and well, today as well. And then he eventually published a coffee-sized table book of 6,000 photographs titled Snow Crystals. And the book was published by the leading publishers, McGraw-Hill. And so this was quite a coup for a young man who was, you know, homeschooled. He also published articles on snowflakes in Popular Mechanics magazine, in the world's leading scientific magazine called Nature, and of course in the more common, widely circulated magazines like the National Geographic in 1923. Unfortunately, I have most of these magazines, so I was able to look them up in the National Geographic. And from our standards today, they were good and beautiful, but not to the quality that we can get today. Today, the techniques are such where we end up with incredibly gorgeous pictures of snowflakes. And I have four or five books which illustrate this, and you can see the beauty is there quite vividly. And you can appreciate more than in his day, but on the other hand, in his day, you know, seeing a picture of a snowflake just astounded people. And that's why his work became so popular. Another contribution he made, which turned out to be very important, was every snowflake, as far as he could tell, was different. And he wondered why. Why are they different? And so he studied the process of the manufacture, the production of snowflakes, and realized they fall in certain conditions. They move upward because of weather conditions, so they move up and down in the clouds, and after a while they end up being exposed in different amounts of heat and cold in different conditions, and that produces the variety that we see in snowflakes. But he discovered they all have either six sides or three sides, and now we understand part of the reason for the difference is because water molecules are not all the same. We have a water molecule called deuterium, which is called heavy water, which is a little bit different than most common water molecules. And now this is a rare molecule. It's not found very commonly, but each snowflake is made out of several hundred trillion water molecules. And so even if we only have a few of these molecules that are deuterium, we therefore end up with differences because of these few molecules. Because when you're talking about 1,000,000,000,000,000,000 water molecules, even if you have a, you know, million billion, then these rogue molecules such as deuterium produce differences. And so he really did a lot of work in chemistry and physics and science and understanding specifically why there are so many snowflake differences. And so therefore, it helps us appreciate the variety in nature. And one thing you learn about nature when you study nature is there is an enormous amount of variety everywhere. In animals, in beetles. One scientist said God has an inordinate fondness of beetles because he made so many kinds. And I guess there are 6,000-7,000 different kinds of beetles. And so therefore, one thing we know when we look at the natural world is enormous variety everywhere, even in snowflakes. And his inspiration, again, was to understand God's creation. You learn about God by studying his creation, which is true because you learn about an artist by studying his artwork. You learn about a musician by studying his music compositions. You learn about God by studying his creation. And, of course, his creation would be the natural world. And so my background is science, so I agree that that's true. And many scientists that I know, their motivation is to understand and learn about God. And certainly we can see that was true in Snowflake Bentley. That's why I became fascinated with him, because he's different. He's not the usual person who goes to college and gets his PhD in physics and goes on and studies nature. He's totally homegrown, and therefore he was original and wasn't constrained by the belief back then that you'll never photograph snowflakes because it just can't be done because the heat of the microscope, you got to get light in there to see it. And that light is heat, and therefore that's going to melt the snowflakes. You can't do it. And he had a hard time at first. He failed, I think, for 2 or 3 years, and he wasn't able to get one single photograph, but eventually he got thousands. As Edison once said, the key to invention is not creativity, but simply perseverance. Keep trying, keep working. The local elementary school, I was asked to come in and do a presentation on Snowflake Bentley because they studied him in this school. And so his ideas and his example still inspires young people today. And there are a lot of children's books about him, and so therefore it's a good example for all of us.
Great work as always by Greg Hengler for digging up this story and for producing the piece, and a special thanks also to Jerry Bergman for sharing the story of Wilson Willie Bentley, a beauty, here on Our American Stories. This is Our American Stories, and now it's time for our Rule of Law series, where we tell stories about what happens when the rule of law is present or absent in our lives. Our own Alex Cortez brings us this next story.
This is the story of three residents of Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
My name's Craig Richardson. I'm an economics professor at Winston-Salem State University.
I'm Matthew Bryant, and I've practiced law in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
My name is Paula Smith. I sell flexible benefit plans, so FSAs, HSAs, HRAs. I have a wealth of knowledge of HSAs and FSAs, so if anyone needs to ask me questions, I can answer those questions.
I was driving on my way to work, and I heard a story on my local NPR station about a couple named James and Phyllis Nelson. They bought this little dream home outside of Winston-Salem. Surrounded by hardwoods, looking out their bedroom window, they could see Pilot Mountain. And what they started to relay was something which was shocking to me, which was the fact that one day when they woke up in 1996, this was about 17 years earlier, they woke up to see the government workers driving stakes in their lawn. And they came out to ask what was going on, and they said, well, this is where a road's coming through. A highway, a future highway. And it's the center line of the road, and it's going to go 200 feet on each side of these stakes. It turns out that that road goes right through his kitchen, right through the middle of his home.
This whopping surprise arrived for Paula Smith, too.
bought the house that we lived in for 29 years in Winston-Salem. So at that time, we didn't know anything about a highway coming through our neighborhood. There was a lot of years there that we were living not knowing what was about to happen to us, that's for sure.
Now, when we hear a story like that, you know, I think we know that sometimes this happens. We have eminent domain, which means the government has the right to have public projects and they buy out homes. But what gave the twist to this story was that
the Department of Transportation was using a law passed by our General Assembly in the late 80s that allowed the department to make road plans that would restrict the development and use of property indefinitely until the department got around to acquiring and getting ready to construct the roadways.
It turns out that there's something called the Transportation Corridor Map Act. What gave this a very unusual twist was that in North Carolina, unlike any other state, which also there are other states that have map acts, but unlike any other state in the United States, there was no time limit on when these roads could be built. In other words, the DOT, the Department of Transportation, could plan a road, could say it would happen sometime in the future, and essentially have carte blanche to decide whenever that road would be built. And these were called road corridors. Now, why would the DOT do something like this? Well, the original intent was that this idea would save taxpayers money. The idea behind that was that if we designate your house in a road corridor and we're going to eventually buy your house out, we don't want you to put in a new kitchen. We don't want you to add a garage or add value in any way because that's going to cost taxpayers more money. So we're going to put you in this road corridor and we're going to say that basically any idea you have about improving your value property is frozen. Now, for the vast majority of states, they have about, you know, less than a year. They have to act or the corridor goes away. But again, in North Carolina, there was no time limit whatsoever. This gave the power to the state, a tremendous amount of power, and it locked people like James Nelson in for years, if not decades.
I had never really heard of this law. However, they used it in Winston-Salem back in 1997 and restricted hundreds and hundreds of properties and didn't pay for it. And the owners were all sort of stuck waiting for the department, and the department never really got around to funding that road and building it. So that had festered since the 90s through the 2000s until 2009.
We put the house on the market in November of 2006. So we've redone all this stuff. It's now better than it was. Let's sell this house and let's go find something else we want to build. And the realtor comes out, puts the sign in the yard. She does her due diligence. She comes back and she says, about 2 weeks after the house had been on the market, she comes back and she says, I think you've got a problem. And she said, your house is going to be taken by the DOT. I said, oh, no, it's not. It's going to be like three or four houses down away from us. It's not coming through our yard. They're not taking our house. She said, oh, yes, they are. They're taking your house. They're coming all the way to the corner now. And I was like, oh, no, now what? She said, well, I have to take the house off the market. There's no other buyer for your house other than the DOT. She said, no one's going to buy your house knowing that eventually a road's coming through and you know your only buyer is the DOT. I went, oh, okay, well, this is interesting. Now what do we do? And she said, you sit and wait. And I thought, this is not right. This is just not right. You can't just tell me I can't sell, tell us we can't sell our house. And she said, I in good faith as a realtor cannot sell your house to anyone else. So we took the house off the market and we sat there and went, okay, now what?
And one of Matthew's business clients was also a victim.
And B. Roth Oil Company was sitting on a very valuable piece of property that was, you know, underutilized. It was basically, they had to park used cars on it because for 20 years, the department had not let it, or at that time, about 15 years, had not let it get a building permit to do anything because it was trying to keep property prices down for its ultimate acquisition of the properties. And my immediate reaction on that day in late summer of 2009 was, that cannot possibly be the law. it struck me immediately as violative of your right to freely use your property. As long as it conforms with zoning, they can't stop me from doing something legally permissible on my property. I said, they can't stop us doing things legally. So I said, okay, well, let me figure this out. And in the span of a day or two, I figured that this kind of legal gimmick had been used, because it's not too novel. You know, if you want to pay some less for something, just don't let anybody freely use it and the price will go down. They had done this thing 25 or 6 times throughout the state. Well, they had tried that in Florida in the early 90s, and it had been almost immediately challenged and struck down as unconstitutional. And we said, well, they can't do this. The department will tell them to just give us the building permit or buy us, and we'll tell them this is why. And lo and behold, we went back and forth with the Department of Transportation, and they had no interest in considering what we were doing or really undoing their practice of restricting these properties. And so they told us to just, you know, jump off a, you know, the cliff. And I said, oh, we got to do something about this. And the client, B. Roth, and my partners all said, yeah, this is unconstitutional. Let's go figure out what to do.
And we're listening to our Rule of Law series. North Carolina legislators and the DOT are clearly violating the rule of law by completely disregarding their own citizens' constitutional rights to own property and not have it taken without just compensation. That's the eminent domain clause, these people were referring to in the story. All to make their own jobs easier, and by the way, to bring down the price for the so-called good of the taxpayers. Because again, if you can't negotiate with anybody but the Department of Transportation, how do you find out the real value of your home? What happens next in this story? Will the rule of law ultimately reign in North Carolina? We'll find out next after this break. This is Our American Story. Continue with Our American Stories and the story of North Carolina's MAP Act that allowed the state to essentially freeze the improvement, development, or sale of private property. Let's return to one of the affected homeowners and landowners, Paula Smith.
We talked to the DOT and they said, oh, probably within, you know, 2 years, 3 years, we'll be out there and we'll be, you know, buying your house and you'll be on your way. So 2008, we got a new governor in North Carolina. And Ms. Perdue had her own agenda, as most governors do. She had her own areas of the state that she favored, I should say. And the beltway around Winston-Salem went from being, I think we were like priority number 4 or 5 in the state, to being priority number 25. There was another group of environmentalists called the Friends of Forsyth. And the Friends of Forsyth then filed a lawsuit against the highway being built because of some environmental issues. There was some creek that had some kind of creature in the creek that was going to be displaced, and the creek was going to be altered, and so the environmentalists got involved. So that basically, from 2008 to 2010, the DOT was going, we can't do anything in the midst of this mess with the Friends of Forsyth. I think I even commented one time, the Friends of Forsyth were no friends of ours because, you know, they were fighting against the highway being built. I'm sitting here with a house we can't sell because the DOT has a map on us that says you're going to take our house, but we don't know when. It was just a mess. It's just a total mess.
Thankfully, the lawsuit was dismissed in 2010. And around this time, Paula met Beverly Reynolds, whose family business had a property that couldn't be expanded or sold because of this MAP Act.
And she said, well, let's have a meeting. Well, she got Steve Trogdon, who was the head of the DOT, happened to be in Winston-Salem that day. So somehow or other, she got him to come to our meeting. I went out and put flyers in mailboxes and said, we're having a meeting at 7 o'clock on this date. please be present. You'll find out what's going to happen. So we had a good 65, 70 people at that meeting. And of course, that's when Steve Trogdon stood there in front of all of us in 2010 and said, I don't know when we're ever going to build your highway. I don't know when we're ever going to take your houses, but you're in the map and we're going to buy your houses, but we can't tell you when. It could be 25 years from now before we buy your house. I think we all just kind of, our mouths just dropped open and went, you can't stand here and say that. I mean, you just cannot stand here and say something to these people that this is their lives. This is their, you know, their land, their jobs, their, you know, and you can't just stand here and say that. He just didn't care. I mean, I guess he was trying to be honest with us, but he just seemed very cold about the whole thing.
The B. Roth Oil Company said, go find us some other plaintiffs and turn this into a class action, which we met with owners.
They had a big group meeting.
They, as you will hear, are as conversant as anybody on the face of the earth about the wrongs that the government can do when it thinks it's doing good for the public. And Paula Smith, who I think I may have heard her name before we showed up, within seconds when I said, does anybody want to do it? Boom, she's up at the front.
We didn't hesitate. You know, again, I think after hearing the Mr. Trogdon guy at the head of the DOT say it could be another 25 years, my husband and I looked at each other and said, this is not right. We have to do something. And Matthew, he wanted somebody to join the lawsuit. And I believed in him. I'm not that kind of person that's going to sit around and do nothing. I sometimes get myself in trouble. Sometimes I say things I shouldn't say sometimes because I just, you know, believe that you've got to stand up for yourself.
Paula and Kenny were always the face of the litigation through the class action. So we said to everyone, the more people we get, the more weight it has. And I said, you know, you don't charge up a hill at the opponent with five people. You send 500 people up the hill. By the time we started showing up at the appellate courts, we had 50 or 60 cases. Then the next time we visited, we had 70, 80, or 90, we had maybe 90 cases. Every time we showed up, we had more cases. And the Supreme Court and the judges and justices knew this. So, yes, the fact that this was statewide and on such a large scale and not just a little one-off in some little town someplace absolutely gave it gravity.
I know I took my daughter, this might have been the Court of Appeals hearing that we went to in Raleigh. She said, I want to go too and see what this is about. And she was just amazed. I mean, she's like, this is really, okay. I'm going to say bad. This is really bad, you know, because of course she's a 20-something at that time, and she's like, this is really bad, and I'm like, yes, this is. I mean, it's kind of fun to watch. The courtrooms were packed. I mean, Matthew did a good job of getting people to go to the courtrooms and being in the courtrooms and letting the judge and the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court see that, you know, these are real people that are being affected here. These people sitting here in this room are the ones being affected. It always bothered me. So I go to these meetings at the churches, or I go to the meetings at the court hearings, and you look around the room, and the majority of people, I get a little teary-eyed talking about this. You get in these rooms, and these people that are in these rooms are all in probably mid-60s to late-60s to 70s to 80s. These are people that have lived in their homes their whole lives, or their family farms and things like that, that the DOT had no... They didn't care. They just had no compassion for these people whatsoever. And you'd hear that somebody passed away, and then now their family, they couldn't finalize the estate because the DOT is holding on to their land and won't pay them out. And, you know, it's like, this is so sad what they were doing to people's lives. And it was just wrong. I'm glad that we fought it.
I was really happy to see that this case was ultimately brought up to the North Carolina Supreme Court, and the MAP Act was overturned in 2019 after more than 30 years of people enduring the MAP Act. I know a person who had wanted to retire in Florida, was unable to sell their home, and died in that home because they were stuck. The irony of the MAP Act is it was supposed to save taxpayers money by giving the state power to hold on to land until it needed to be developed and pay a lower price. But in fact, it is incredible in terms of how much this has backfired. because homeowners have fought for their property rights, the property rights that are constitutionally guaranteed, have sued the state, and now are owed money that is many times multiple of the original home. And the lawsuits, according to one estimate, could cost the state over $1 billion. So this is an unfortunate road, so to speak, that the state took.
Whatever they have saved, they are now having to pay for it. You know, it has increased their anticipated acquisition costs in today's dollars two or threefold.
You know, the judge says these people are entitled to interest back to the date of the taking. So the date of the taking, I think, was for us was 2008. I think it was 8% interest, which was a nice sum of money. And because they kept dragging this out in court, we got a lot more money for our house in 2019 than we would have gotten for our house in 2010. But it's because they just kept dragging it out and dragging it out and dragging it out.
In my own backyard, there are 3,000 people who have property rights that is very similar to a country I've been studying for 15 years, Zimbabwe. In fact, they have the worst property rights in the entire country. And what I did was I said, well, let's pretend that this area outside of my city is a little country. Let's stack it up against a well-known property rights index put out by the Heritage Foundation, a think tank based in Washington, D.C., which has a very well-regarded property rights index. And what I did when I sort of put in, here's what the power you have to sell your property, here's the power to upgrade your property, here's the power to go to the bank, I found out that in fact, the people had property rights that were equal to living in some of the worst countries in the world. That would be places like Zimbabwe or Cuba. That's why I named the title of one of my articles, Is This North Carolina or Zimbabwe? How property rights in North Carolina deteriorated to the level of a third world country.
What we had learned is that your average Joe does not like lawyers, does not like the government, loves their property, and would rather be left alone, at least as a road going through their living room. So we had to overcome their distrust of lawyers and their distrust of the government and their distrust of the court system. And they have all been rewarded with putting their faith in us. And that is a reward beyond the money we've made people. It's a professional reward that I gather most people don't get to have in their career. And it's been very gratifying.
It's just been an ordeal from the beginning. And I guess that's why I got a little teary-eyed, because it's finally almost over. And it's like I can kind of let my emotions get the best of me now, because it's over.
It is indeed over. And what voices we heard there. What a story about property rights. Great storytelling by Alex Cortez, as always. The rule of law, North Carolina's MAP Act, no longer. This is Our American Stories.